Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Wing and Tail Boys podcast, your Northeast hunting and fishing destination. I'm Chris.
And I'm Angelo.
And we're your hosts. Join us as we navigate the woods and waters of the Northeast, sharing our passion for the outdoors.
Whether it's land management, outdoor recreation, hunting, or fishing, we're going to cover it all. With 40 plus years of experience in the Northeast, we'll provide insights, tips, and stories to help you make the most of your adventures and help you experience the wild.
So, tune in, grab your gear, and let's hit the woods together. And always remember, success is just a commitment away. Wing and Tail Boys Podcast is brought to you by Truthsticks Custom Arrows. Built with FireKnock technology, Truthsticks Custom Arrows simply fly flatter, spin faster, and improve arrow efficiency downrange. With two signature arrows for the compound bow and a signature crossbow bolt, they've got something for everyone. If you're ready to take the guesswork out of archery and take the best performing arrow into the field, then check out Truthsticks Custom Arrows at wingandtailoutdoors.com and experience the truth of Aeroflight.
How are we doing, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to another episode of the Wing and Tail Outdoors Podcast. As I record today's intro, it is Tuesday, September 30th, and we have just finished our third weekend of the New Jersey season. This weekend, there wasn't really any action to share. My brother didn't get anything. My cousins didn't get anything. I didn't have much luck. Went back to where I was hunting on opening day, where I had those, that encounter with the doe, a couple bucks, some unknown deer that I saw from the distance. And I tried to hit the other side of the thicket, try to change up my location, play the wind a little bit, and I just ended up not seeing anything. I've come to find out since then that some areas are raining acorns and others are just dry as can be. And I just happen to be in one of the patches of woods where the acorns are a little drier. So it is what it is. It's all good. I have some new stuff to share with you guys. A couple of new things that I'm working on still. Once again, you guys know I'm always tinkering, always adding, changing stuff in my setup. And this week, I'm going to bring you that hybrid episode that I was talking about last week. So what I'm going to do is we're going to talk about a little something. I'm a little fired up about something, to be honest with you. So we're going to talk about that here for a little bit. And then I'm just going to break off into a science of Aeroflight episode. This will be an episode about Nox. Essentially, we actually broke Nox down into a three-part section or three-section piece or however you want to say it. And we basically ended up in the first episode, well, really the first two episodes, talking about how Nox are produced, how they're made, the problems with the building process, the pros and cons, so on and so forth, and then why they're important. Long story short, the reason why we decided to spend so much time on the Nox is because it's one of the only two places where we have any control over our arrow. When you think about shooting a gun, whether it's a rifle, a long gun, or pistol, whatever it is, when you shoot it, that bullet is in the barrel making full-on contact with that firearm from the moment you pull the trigger until the moment it leaves your bow or it leaves the gun. Now, rifles tend to be more accurate because they have a longer barrel and those bullets spend more time in the barrel, which makes them more accurate if the shooter has strong form. The downside of that is when the barrel is longer, when the barrel's longer, again, that bullet spends more time in the barrel, which means you have to stay held on target for longer because, you know, there's a longer period of time where you can make a difference. It's very similar to the brace height of a bow. The longer the brace height, the less time your arrow is on the bow. The shorter your brace height, the longer it's on the bow. But when we're talking about arrows and bow and arrows and flight, the nock and the rest are the only two places where our arrow makes contact with our bow. And for something as little and as simple as a nock, a piece of plastic or polymer, or some people use aluminum or metal nocks even, it seems like such a redundant piece of the puzzle, but it is such a strong link in the chain, or it needs to be. And that's kind of why we spent so much time talking about that. If you guys are interested in learning more about nocks, stay tuned after this episode. Now, as I record this, again, it is Tuesday, September 30th. Tomorrow, Wednesday the 1st, starts hunting season in New York. And we have been fired up as a family ever since these bucks started losing velvet. Because the moment, so we had about a week and a half, 2 week span where we had the bucks, we had the deer, the bucks and everything in our food plots regularly. I mean, they've been absolutely loving that Vitalize Seed Nitro Boost fall plot. Ever since it's been growing in, those deer have been absolutely hammering it. So up until, I don't know, I want to say late August, I guess you could say, maybe early September, we had the bucks on camera regularly. And then all of a sudden, they just disappeared for about a week and a half, 2 weeks. When they came back, they no longer had velvet. And we have not been to the property, at least on the actual hunting piece of our property. We haven't been up there since the last time we went and finalized our food plots. If you remember last time we went, we checked the growth of our Vitalize seed, of the carbon load. Everything was growing relatively nicely. And then, that weekend we checked it. My brother and I spread some foliar fertilizer as well as some granular fertilizer. And then when I came back the following week, I feathered in some rye. We have not been back there since. Anyway, this is a long-winded way of saying that ever since those bucks showed up back on our food plots, they have just been absolutely fired up. I mean, almost every day we're getting pictures of them brawling. If you guys follow along on Instagram, I posted a picture today, actually. The bucks were fighting so hard that both of their necks were basically on the ground as they had their rear ends up in the air trying to push each other back. So whenever we get that first sit in, whether it's tomorrow or Thursday or Friday or Saturday, whatever day that is, I'm going in there with a full bag of tactics ready to go. We have a very, very historic rub line. Every single year we've been on this property, we have a rub line run through the same place. So my goal this weekend, we're going to give my dad the first shot at the food plot. So neither my brother nor myself are going to sit on that food plot where we've been getting all of this action until my dad has a chance to sit it first. So between when my dad starts sitting there and when I get to sit there or my brother, what I'm going to end up doing is I'm going to target this very well-known rub line that runs somewhat down the gut of our property. The way it runs, it's kind of weird. It's kind of catty corner. So it goes from one corner down through the middle and then kind of cuts across and then meanders its way into that food plot where that buck is. Now, we haven't been in there again in probably a month now, maybe 3.5 weeks, so something like that. But I would put every penny in my bank account on the fact that when I walk in there this week, in the next few days, I'm going to find rubs in this area. Now, the question is for me, how do I access it? How do I play the wind? Because the primary wind, the dominant wind, comes out of the northwest, which is not great for our property. All of our access is from like the north, northeast kind of area, which is unfortunate. This weekend, there's mostly a north, northeast wind. So I have to try to find a way to slip in and then kind of cut across the trail and work my way up a little bit and get up, on the downwind side of the trail, but far enough up that that deer won't smell my ground scent. Now, this rub line also runs the base of one of these two fingers that come off two different neighboring properties. My concern is that the downwind side, so the southwest, is basically the bottom of the face of that ridge of that finger. I know I'm not making sense, so let me try to put it in perspective. So we have a northeast wind. We have a wind coming out of the northeast, and this rub line runs this ditch that is at the base of a northeastern facing slope. It's not huge, it's not super steep, but it is one of the two steeper areas on our property. And these deer have been known to come from the top. So I'm not really sure what to do here because I really want to attack this rub line. But at the same rate, I know my thermals are going to rise during the day. They're most likely going to pull up that ridge. And if they're bedded up on top, then that might just ruin it for the entire day, which kind of now, as I'm saying this out loud, it kind of makes sense that this rub line is there because those deer know they're safe. They know they could slip through there. If the wind is coming out of the southwest, then they can smell. If it's coming out of the east or the northeast, they get the wind. If they bed up top, they're getting those thermals pulling up. So that might be the kill spot. That might be the X where I need to be because it's the place where those deer feel the most comfortable. So what I might need to do is get far enough back that I'm still hunting on that rub line. I'm still on the downwind side, but I'm also where that slope starts to kind of level out a little bit. It's not as steep. It's not as tall. And maybe that thermal drawing effect will be a little less serious because it's a little less steep. I don't know if that'll work or not, but I've always been afraid in this property, getting too aggressive too early and going too deep too quickly. There's a joke in there. Yeah. But you guys get what I'm saying. So I think there's an old saying, right? There's a Einstein's definition of insanity was doing the same thing over and over the same way and expecting different results. We've waited till late season. It's not so great. We've played it soft early season. It's not so great. We've hunted around the food plots early season and haven't had the success. So at this point, what do I have to lose? So I'm going to get in there. I'm either going to hunt that rub line or I'm going to hunt a bench that sits below the other finger and kind of see how that goes. But that spot is usually really good early November. So we'll see. We'll see what happens with that. So we're hoping by the end of this weekend, New York, you're allowed to hunt on Sundays. We're hoping by the end of this weekend, somebody has an encounter with our number one buck, which I have today actually named Duke because those two bucks were duking it out yesterday. And our number one beat our number two. So number one's name is Duke. Number two, I don't have a name for him. To be honest with you, I don't know that I'm going to shoot him. If I see him, it might be a hard pass on the fly, but sitting here in front of my camera, looking at the pictures and knowing what we have, I would say right now in this moment that I would pass that number two if I were to see him, but we'll see, we'll play it by ear when the time comes. Pennsylvania also opens this weekend, this Saturday. If I am successful before the weekend in New York, then I'll be transitioning over to Pennsylvania. I found a really nice buck on some public land. I think I may or may not have talked about that last week. So that's, I'm really excited for that. So, and I got myself 3 doe tags for PA this year. So when I'm not hunting New York, I'll most likely be hunting PA. And the only way I could really see myself hunting Jersey again this year is if I got to go, you know, if we go to visit my family, our family in Jersey, and I have a chance to slip away, I'll probably go hunt Jersey. Or if I have some early quick success in Pennsylvania, then I might break off after work and go hunt Jersey a couple times before the clocks roll back and we lose some daylight and I don't really have the time to go hunting after work. Excuse me. Next up, I had mentioned last week that I didn't really have my camera with me. And the reason was because that I needed to get a new camera. So I had been running the Panasonic Lumix GH5, which is just a phenomenal camera for video in general. But that Micro Four Thirds sensor, I don't want to get into sensor stuff and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, just know that, you know, the Micro Four Thirds sensor is smaller than a full frame camera, which means it allows less light in. I can imagine that you can understand that that could cause some problems in low light that I didn't realize until opening day. I took a video of a small little six pointer that I saw on the corn that I had put out about an hour and a half before last light. And that picture was so grainy and the quality wasn't quite what I was looking for. And I decided instead of buying a new lens that it was better to just trade everything in, buy a better body, a better full frame body. My dad was kind enough to let me use some of his lenses. So right now we're rolling. Hopefully this weekend I can get some of that going. I got myself a screen to throw on top of my camera. So I'm really excited about that. I've never used one of them before. I'll actually be able to see what I'm looking at in the woods, which is really great. And I feel like there was one more thing that I wanted to talk to you guys about gear-wise or whatnot, but it doesn't matter. I'm sure I'll remember either later or next week. Now, the thing that has really been grinding my gears lately, and I guess it's been talked about a little bit as of late, which is why maybe I'm starting to feel a little bit more comfortable talking about it. At the same rate, I feel like it's something that more of us need to start becoming more comfortable talking about. And this is really the concept of, I guess you can kind of bunch it all together. Hunters being unethical or poaching or purposely breaking the laws, that really bugs me. There's also a lot of non-hunters or anti-hunters that are really getting away with a lot of stuff that they really shouldn't. And I'm going to break some of these things down on what I mean. First off, from a hunting perspective, we all understand that our sport is at a very crucial point where you don't have as many young people getting involved. The older generation is kind of slipping away. People my age, the middle class, the working class, they're working more and they're finding less time to get out in the woods. And it is becoming so easy for people who don't appreciate or agree with our lifestyle. When there's less of us involved and there's less of us speaking up, it becomes a lot easier for them to push what they're doing, you know, to get seasons taken away, to get more gun control laws, to limit bag limits, to, for example, closing the bear hunt or coyote hunts, stuff like that, guys. So first and foremost, we all really need to band together, and not just when things get bad. Like, we all did a really great job of banding together and stopping that land sale. Like, that was really great a couple months ago. Hunters, non-hunters, it didn't matter. If you enjoyed the outdoors or cared about public lands, we all banded together and we saw what difference we can make when we all band together. And we have to do that and be proactive ahead of the curve. So that way we have more strength going into an issue to resolve it than we would otherwise. Now, what I mean with stuff like this too, guys, is when we're hunters and we're out there blatantly breaking the law, or we're doing unethical things, taking unethical shots, all the above, trespassing, not calling for permission to track a deer on somebody else's property. Like, all of these things are just little things that don't seem like such a big deal to some people, but it's what gives those who don't agree with our way of life the ammunition that they need to get stuff going. Like, I've been sitting here itching for weeks trying to get in the woods, and I couldn't imagine being told that I couldn't do that anymore because I'm a minority, or we are a minority, or we didn't have enough people speak up to fight for our liberty to be out in the woods, for lack of a better way to put it, that it was taken away, you know. And like, my cousin and I, we were just talking today, and he said something about how last year he saw someone doing something illegal with, you know, with a turkey. I don't know the details of it. He reported it and the game warden kind of just like brushed it off and didn't do anything about it. So if we as hunters are trying to conserve our resource, preserve wildlife, improve the environment, create habitat, save habitat, if we're out there, if we're really supposed to be the eyes and ears, if you see something, say something. And then whenever we bring something up, nothing gets done about it. That's really frustrating from a hunter standpoint, because it's like we're trying to do things the right way. And we're trying to protect these animals and these resources. We're trying to be ethical. We're trying to make the right decisions. And when you do everything the right way, nothing gets done about it. And it's disheartening. It's exhausting sometimes. I heard stories last year where there were anti-hunters who were blatantly, purposely out in the woods throwing donuts and stuff out in the woods. So that way the entire forest was considered a baiting site and hunters weren't allowed to hunt in that area. Now, the way the law is written, it's illegal to do that. It's illegal to hinder someone's ability to go out and hunt. And yet nothing was done about it. Like, that to me is extremely frustrating. And then we had our buddy Brian Melvin, who goes out and shoots this beautiful bear and does very much so right by the bear. And, you know, he missed out on the unofficial record because he decided to gut it instead of risking spoiling the meat, bringing it full. You know, like, we have guys out here making the right decisions. And then through all of that, not only is Brian getting, you know, backlash from the non-hunting community, he's getting backlash from the hunting community. You know, people saying that he didn't really shoot it, or it wasn't as heavy as it was, or, you know, that he shot it in the wrong place, or he did this wrong or that wrong. Like, what are we doing, guys? You know, if you guys listen to that episode where Brian and I talked about that and the aftermath of all of that, he said that he was getting death threats. His family was getting death threats from people. And he said that he was getting more support or equal support from the non-hunting community, saying that he didn't do anything wrong and he did a great job and all this stuff, than he was from the hunting community. Guys, it's backwards. It's backwards. We have people in the hunting industry, people whose names are on products, or people who are out there teaching people how to hunt or trying to show people the way, that are doing things incorrectly, whether it's poaching or baiting or doing something illegal or breaking the rules. If we're out here trying to teach it, guys, if a new kid, 10, 12, 15 years old, is just getting into hunting for the first time and is just coming across one of these people's videos and they're learning how to do things the wrong way, or they're being told that this stuff is being done in fair chase when in reality it's not, that just doesn't sit right with me. And if there's someone out there who I knowingly know that this is being done with or being done by, or has tried to skirt the rules or skirt the laws or try to teach someone the wrong thing or lie and say that they're doing something that they're not, I refuse to give them attention. I refuse to follow them. I refuse to give them any money. It's just, never mind. And I'm not even saying that their product or products may or may not work. I'm sure they do. But for me, it's just the principle of the matter. We're out here. We're supposed to be stewards of the land. We're supposed to be stewards of our sport. We're supposed to be raising the next generation to do it better than us. And I see these jokes online, you know, about, you know, trespassing and hunting on other people's lands. And it's all fun and games and jokes and whatnot. But at the end of the day, it's not okay. We have this property up in New York. We have the ability. Technically, it's illegal to bait in New York. I cannot put a corn pile down in New York. I guarantee you, if I wanted to, we can go out and buy as many bags of corn as we want and pile them up wherever we want on our property, and no one would ever find out. But it wouldn't be the right thing to do, and I wouldn't be okay with it, and it wouldn't be fair to everyone else in our area who may or may not be working hard on their property. You know, who am I to break the law and put some corn down on the ground and attract these deer when our neighbor is out there breaking their ass trying to plant a food plot? It's just not right. I don't know, guys. Maybe I care too much. I probably care too much if I'm being honest, but that's just something that bugs me, especially if we're in the industry. Like, we all know that there are people out there breaking the law, no matter what you're doing in sports, baseball, football, basketball. There's somebody on PEDs right now cheating the system and doing it and getting away with it. In golf, fishing, in hunting, in everything, in anything, there's someone breaking the law, but it doesn't mean that we need to do it too. And if we're someone who's out there trying to teach new people, new enters, hunters into our sport how to do this the right way, then we should be doing it the right way. I don't know, man. That's just one man's opinion. But yeah, I think that's good. I think that's where we're going to leave it off. We'll just wrap it up here. Just talk about, I guess, some of our sponsors again real quick. Ratgetter Sense, from this point forward, is a staple in my bag. I'm going to be carrying the pre-rut and the rut sense. My philosophy on them, I think I talked about that last week, but I'll touch on it again real quick. From the moment those bucks lose their velvet, they are ready to rock. They're looking for that first hot doe. And the closer they get to, you know, whatever their region's time of breeding is, the more fired up they're going to be and the harder they're going to be searching. But they're always on the lookout for that first hot doe. So if My mock scrape is the first one that has some estrus scent in it. Who's to say that it's not going to attract deer early on? That's my philosophy. If they're looking for that first hot doe, give them the first hot doe, give them a reason to come in. So I'm going to be using the climax on the ground, all the different urines, the rut smells, all that, the doe and estrus, hot doe, hot buck, dominant buck, all those things I'm using. But I'm also utilizing rope scrapes. I'm also utilizing some of the attractant spray as a cover scent. So regardless of what I'm using, I don't use every single thing in each sit, but every sit I'm using something from Rat Getter Scents. And so far, for the most part, these last two sits have kind of been crap. I didn't put myself in the best spots, to be honest with you. But so far on camera, all these scrape sites I've made using the Rat Getter Scents, they've all been successful. They're all active. And I'm really looking forward to seeing success in the field come from that. But the nested tree stand system, you guys already know, I absolutely love it this year. This is my first year putting it to the test. I now have 3 or 4 climbs with it, like full setups with the camera gear and the bag and the bow and hanging and doing the whole thing. And so far, I absolutely love it. I think you guys will love it too. Even with the amount of weight that I have in my bag between the tree stand, the rails, the bag, my camera gear, all of that stuff, my water, my food, all this stuff that I bring in with me. It's not crazy heavy. I'm sure there's people out there who are carrying heavier, but it's well over 20 pounds, 25 pounds maybe on my back, maybe even a little bit more. But the beautiful part is that the harness that comes, that is built into the nested tree stand system, the shoulder yokes, the waist strap, the load lifter straps, they all work together to put all of the weight of the pack on your hips and on your waist where all of that weight belongs, and it takes it off of your shoulders. So it makes that 25 pound pack really feel like 10. And I'm not just exaggerating. Last week I was in this thick stuff. The stand was kind of getting caught. I'm short. So the way I need to set everything is, you know, the teeth kind of stick up a little bit over my head. So even though my head clears some branches, that tree stand doesn't always clear it either. And I was ducking and moving and crawling through all that thick stuff, trying to get through. And I did not feel hindered by the pack whatsoever. Where in the past, carrying packs that were roughly the same weight, you know, if I leaned one direction or the other, all that weight shifted one way and it pulled me. And, you know, it was just a workout trying to get the stand in also. I don't get that with the nested. Once I get up, it's very, very comfortable. Those light rails are absolutely stuck to that tree. I have no fear, no doubt whatsoever that those rails are going to stay where I put them and where they lock in. And once I get to the top of the stand, it is very easy to level out the base. It is very easy to level out the seat. And whether you're sitting in the saddle position, using it as a hybrid, or using it as a regular hang on and sitting down, you will absolutely be comfortable all day long. The pack I use, I always forget if it's the 30 liter or the 35 liter. I'm pretty sure it's 30. But what I really love about it is it has a pocket on the very, very top. It's a top loading pouch, and it's big enough literally for me to fit my full frame camera, full lens, the converter for the lens, because I use a Nikon lens on a Sony body. So I need that converter. All of that connected fits right in the top there. And then it's got pockets on the side where I could put my shotgun mic, my portable chargers, my batteries, all of these different things that I need, all for my camera setup, are right there on top. And then everything else kind of gets put in the bag all around. I absolutely love it. You guys know the deal. If you're interested in checking out the Nested Tree Stand system, down below in the description, there's a link to their website. That is a link specific to us. And or at checkout, you can use the code WT10 to save yourself 10% on your entire order. And it also goes a little way to help this podcast out as well, if that is something that you would like to do. Gosh, I feel like I'm forgetting a whole bunch today. I don't know, guys. I'm at a loss. Oh my goodness, I did forget something. I can't believe I waited till all the way to the end. So if you guys are still listening at this point, baby update. Lily is not only eating solids now, she is feeding herself, like literally taking the spoon and feeding herself. She is starting to eat with her hands, starting to figure out that she could pick things up and put them in her mouth. And it has been off to the races now. Not only that, but our baby girl said her first word this week, and it was mama, which honestly, we all expected. My wife has been a rock star through all of this. Right now, her job is stay-at-home mom, and she is absolutely killing it. She has been making sure that the baby gets exercise every day, spending time on the tummy, practicing sitting up, practicing crawling, which she is like days away from doing that too. Now, I know my wife doesn't listen to the podcast here. very often, but I'm going to go ahead and just say it anyway. My wife has been an absolute rock star through all of this. She makes sure the baby gets everything she needs, the attention that she needs. She's ahead of milestones because of my wife. She's as strong as she is because of my wife. All of the credit to everything that our child is doing goes to her, because without her, none of this would be possible. I wouldn't be able to enjoy this podcast and share this everything with you guys. And it's just everything is possible because she is just absolutely killing it as Mrs. Romano. So thank you very much. Love you. And with that said, guys, we're going to wrap it up here this week. Like I said, this is about, I don't know, when by the time I edit this down, it'll probably be around 25 minutes of an intro / part one. Part two is about to go into the Knox, which we had just talked about. If this is where you guys are going to break off, I want to thank you so much for joining us here for another episode of the Wing and Tail Outdoors podcast, where success is always just a commitment away. And you know where to find us next week, Tuesday, guys. Every week, I can't believe we're 60 episodes in at a time. Wow, time flies. But anyway, that's enough from me. We're going to go into the Knox conversation with Dorge. This is an older conversation from before I had this new mic set up and all this stuff. So it might sound a little different than you guys are used to, but the information is just absolutely incredible. So again, thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next week. Without further ado, Dorge Wong. How are we doing today, Dorge? Welcome back to the Wing and Tail Boys podcast.
I'm doing quite well.
Awesome, man. Awesome. Today is a very exciting day. We are getting into a very important concept as far as arrow building is concerned, and one of the best, most important components in my eyes, and probably the smallest one that most people forget about. They don't really see the value in it. Today, we're going to be talking all about the Knox.
Yes, it's all about the Knox.
All about the Knox. And
yes,
what makes the Knox so important, and what a lot of people seem to, in my opinion, overlook, is the fact that once the arrow leaves our bow, we don't have control of it anymore. We have to trust that how we built the arrow is going to suffice from release to impact. But when the arrow's on the bow and we're at full draw, when we release our string, there are only two parts of our bow, of our entire system, that make contact with the arrow. And those are the arrow rest, which is why we talk so much about the node, while we've talked about the node a lot in the past, and the knock. Which there's so many out there, and it's so, like, of all the components in all of building arrows, I feel like people give the least amount of attention to the Knox. Would you agree with that?
As a matter of fact, if you remember my company, we started with the Knox. Let me give you an idea. If you think of the Knox of an arrow, it's like the tires of a sports car. That's the best way you think about it. That's the best way you need to think about your Knox as the tires. First of all, they will never last forever. Second, they need to be as precise as possible. And third, they are always ultra high performance. Because I don't care what car you got. I mean, imagine this, you just got yourself as a Lamborghini, whatever. And then I give you some serious roll handler. You're not going to like the way it behaves. But at the same time, if you got a truck, I give you some high performance tire, it's not going to work well.
Sure.
You're going to water it down in no time. I mean, the design of that are so different. And they are so critical. I mean, very, very simple. Do anybody know what is the most important thing about a knock to the bow?
The fit?
Yes, the fit. What does that mean? Do you know, by quote-unquote, the original AMS store, that if I recall correctly, is 0.88, 0.98, 112. Three numbers.
Those are the three opening sizes, like the mouth
size? No, three size of the serving.
Serving, okay, gotcha.
AA is the 88 thousandths of an inch. That's your youth bow. An 98 is supposed to be your normal target bow, and 112 supposed to be your regular bow.
Now, are those serving sizes, the serving diameter, are those similar to arrow classes where they'll say,
no,
okay,
they're not.
Like this string is 112 thousandths, but it could range from, say, 109 to 115. Does that happen? Or
actually works a lot worse than that. Let me give you an idea. I remember the days when I was doing testing on serving size. The serving size in today's world, like today, is average between 105 to 137. You hear me right? 105 to 137.
So there's a difference of 32 thousandths.
Yes.
In diameter.
Yes, and 112 is what you aim for.
See, now this is, in my opinion, this is where custom strings are so important, why they're so valuable. I'll come out, you know, I try not to name drop on here whenever I can. And this is for a good thing, so I don't mind name dropping. But last year or 2 years ago when I was shooting my Hoyt,
I needed new strings. I didn't need new strings. I wanted new strings, right? So I called up Gas. I bought a set of Gas strings and cables. And I said, I'm going to be using the Fire Knock Knocks. I want the serving to be exactly 112 thousandths. I said, can you do that? That was my number one priority when I was having my strings made. And they said, yep, absolutely, no problem. I got it back. I had a digital caliper. I measured it. 112 on the notes. You know, so to me, that's huge. Why is, before we go there, you said something actually when you were talking, you said that tires, knocks on an aero are very similar to tires on a vehicle. And then you used the example of a sports car. The reason why that's so important is because just like building an aero for the application, you have to also match your tires to the vehicle for the application that you're going to be doing. If you live down in Florida, you're not going to go buy all-weather tires or snow tires because they don't have snow down in Florida. But at the same rate, if I'm somebody who works in the forest, I'm going to get all-terrain tires or even off-road tires because I need to make sure that I'm not going to get stuck. So you want to match your tires to the application. Now,
yes, in this specific case, I was sort of like bring you back. Technically, in today's world, that's my practice. Okay, some people will think differently. So if you shoot a vertical bow, it's 112,000. End of story. That 9888, unless you're doing youth like the Genesis and so on. And even with those, what's wrong with the larger diameter? So as far as I'm concerned, if you shoot a vertical bow, the only size you need to ever consider is 112,000.
Yes.
Yes, you're going to have problems with some pinups and so on, but do you really want to shoot that 125,000 ID shaft? Unless you're doing world archery.
Right.
And most of your listeners are not into world archery. They're not going to go to fly to Barcelona or go to Spain and then do the 3D championship there. I mean, hang off the cliff shooting at a goat over the cliff. Most customers don't. I've got a few do.
Never mind shooting at a goat over the cliff. You won't find me within 20 feet of the edge of the cliff. Not this guy. Absolutely not.
No, they hang themselves off the cliff and then shooting a goat on the rock across it.
No, so, thanks.
I mean, if you miss it, your arrow's gone anyway.
No, thanks. I fail.
Or the one they did in Switzerland. No, in Venice. So they shoot the targets on each bridge. So from one bridge, shoot to the other bridge. So yes, if you miss it, you're never seeing your arrow again. You see somewhere down in see the...
Now, What I was getting at there, though, are the knocks are the exact same as the tires. Mind you, there aren't as many knock options as there are tires, but you do have
you'd be surprised.
There are a lot.
Yeah. There are a lot.
You have your regular knocks.
You can buy really cheap ones and some really good ones. But then this is where I would say knock company really, there's two classes of knock company. One, you sell you the cheapest, highest volume. You can technically get a bag of knocks for $6, Walmart. But then if you come to find out, you're looking at $10, you got $7. But the true cost difference is where the night and day become and what precision means. Just like, you know, tires are not tires. I mean, the most important part is the fit. And then, of course, this is where everybody don't understand. Knock fit is one end. The other end is shaft fit. There's two of them.
Yeah. Now,
and on top of that, in 90%, I would say 80 to 85% of the knocks and string, the knot is not made in the center of the arrow. Can you believe that?
No, I don't even want to. I don't even want to think about that. After everything I know, I don't even want to think about that.
But that is a fact. Because what do you mean by center? Center is center, right? Well, how about you offer half thousands? Are you in center?
Well, if you're, no.
But what would you consider in the center? 15th of a thousand? 2 millionth of a thousand? Do you know why the word middle is such a big deal?
I mean, for me as a math guy, no. I mean, for me specifically, there is no
off center.
Yeah, but there is no compromise when it comes to something like that. The center is the center. And if it's not the center, it's not the center. You know what I mean? Like, there's not like, oh shit, I lost the race by one step. No, you lost the race. You know what I mean? Like,
no, this is where things get really, really interesting. Okay? The shaft's supposed to be a circle, right?
Supposed to be.
Yes.
And we talked about this a few episodes ago as far as the science series is concerned. Some arrows don't have a uniform wall diameter around the entire arrow, which causes its own problems in itself.
So in other words, the OD and ID may not be concentric because the ID, if it's a mandrel, it usually is a circle. But then a question, How round is round?
Again, if it's not if it's not perfectly round, it's not round. Like,
just so you know, do you know that the perfectly round is a pipe dream? It never happened.
Yes, it's an anomaly.
Yes.
Yes.
And then perfectly centered is also an anomaly.
Yes.
And especially in knocks. I mean, I want to say that so people fully understand. When you design a knock, you want it to be in the center. But the fact is that it is a plastic. It is injection molded. You're guaranteed not to be in the center. Even if it is in the center, it doesn't work like it was in the center.
Right. And the thing is, do I know why? Well, if it's in the center, it's not going to act like it's in the center because the arrow flexes on release. No? Okay.
Because when your arrow releases, the two prongs on a knock do not behave the same.
Yeah, that makes sense because one is farther away from the point of injection than the other.
Yes. And one, which is the flow, will go in and come back on the other side.
Yeah.
So one prong will be higher density than the other, or higher curing rate than the other, or faster curing than the other. So when you relax this, the left prong and the right prong never, ever, ever behave the same. It would be close. So is your left hand the same as your right hand? That's pretty much what you're asking.
It's the same thing with your feet. Your left foot and your right foot aren't exactly the same. They're close, but they're not quite the same.
Yes, I mean, that's really like my wife. Her left foot is half a size larger.
Or if you're like me on the dance floor, you have two left feet and you have a really big problem.
Well, the reason I want to say that, because I want to point out the first thing for most people. Knock is not just a knock, and you need high performance. Mm-hmm. The manufacturer of a knock and how you put a knock into the string and how the string interact with the knock is so critical. And that's the reason I want to sort of get this out of the way before we talk about sizes. And then not to mention, we want to talk about string fit.
Yeah.
But after the string fit, we want to talk about the shaft fit.
Yes. Now, I want to talk about the string fit, but you brought up a really big concept that I've been wanting to kind of bring up for a little while, and I just wasn't quite sure how to bring it up. But this sounds like a good segue. Mm-hmm. You said that, you know, there are two different types of companies. One type of knock company is going to give you quality. Another type of knock company is just going to sell you max volume at the least price. Now, the biggest thing, I'll be honest with you, and I'm sure you've heard this before because we've talked about this before. When I'm talking about fire knock with people in the archery world, they say the products look great, but they're a lot more expensive than the alternatives. What do you say to a customer like that? Because I know what I say.
Oh, just like everything else. Do you understand what you're buying? I mean, just like, you know, if you want to buy beef, going to McDonald's and get a hamburger with a quarter pound, well, that's beef. Mm-hmm. You want to go to Roof Chris and sit down for a quarter pound filet mignon, that's beef. What's the difference? They're both beef.
One's actually grass-fed? No, I'm just kidding.
No, you don't know that.
No, I mean, I'm just
if you talk to McDonald's, they will tell you everything is grass-fed.
Yeah. It's the quality, of course.
I mean, I think that's a very bad word to use on quality.
Okay.
Is what is your desire to be? Is the real question. Mm-hmm. If you say, I'm going to hunt with my son, and he is going to shoot groups like was out of style, and he don't care how the arrow be favored, and you only shoot 20 yards. Am I going to put fire now? No. I'm going to get some freaking, go to Walmart, get three, or go to Boning and get a bag of whatever, and let him just shoot like hell, because I will guarantee he not shoot off the knocks.
Yeah. It's funny you say that.
Shoot the same.
I have a friend of mine who is interested in a set of arrow concepts. I'm going to build him here in a week or two.
Uh-huh.
He has always been the shooter that you're talking about. You know, you just shoot groups and you don't care what happens. And, you know, trying to Robin Hood every arrow, which I think is awesome. But he also said, when I get your dozen, I got to spray some new spots on my target because I don't want to be shooting them at the same place.
All right.
I had a friend of mine, we were talking about pricing and stuff, and he was like, wow, it's going to cost me that much for a set of arrows. I could just go to Walmart and buy a set of arrows for $60. And what I told him was, sure, of course you can. You can also go buy a set of golf irons for $200. But if you want good irons and you want them custom fitted to you and you want them to work well for you, well, you're probably going to pay $2,000 for them.
Oh, yes, or more.
Or more, you know, so I'm really glad you put it that way. It's not, first off, I do think that your products are a higher quality than some other products.
Well, it's not just higher quality. It's that, do you understand what, I mean, like I always tell people, it is not the price.
Mm-hmm.
It is no, you need to let the customer understand what they are buying. Second, do they have the desire to use to it to its potential? If the answer is no, why are you paying for it?
It's like,
I mean,
it's
if I'm just hungry, I'm going to stroll down the road. I mean, you're going to stroll, you're going to swing by Ruth Chris and get a window of, say, a filet mignon steak you're going to stuff your mouth with. One hand, when it's cold, you're better off swing by Burger King. You're going to enjoy it a lot more.
Yeah. It's the same thing as using, say, like a trip planner, like somebody who helps you plan your trips. Like, could I go on a vacation without that help? Absolutely. Why do I pay somebody to plan my trip for me? Because it makes things smooth and easy and simple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I love the way that you put that. We understand that the products are a little bit more expensive, but it's what you're getting out of them on the back end and how much easier it makes your life. Honestly,
well, at the end of the day, it is your hobby. I mean, it's like me with my fishing rods. Do I really need Torsite titanium guides? I would not have it. If I do not know about it, how would I want it? I mean, it's like back in 20 years ago, everything of mine is Cermaq. I remember back in the 2000s. I mean, I'm the guy who spent one full month's summer vacation salary on a set of Ruby guides. Do I need them? No. Should I have them after I know what they are? No, but I didn't know better.
Yeah, it's like we were talking about like the scent controlling clothes back in the day. You know, we love them and, you know, we fell for it. And then we said, shit, it takes like 10,000 degrees to reset carbon.
No, but the 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit.
I'm being silly. So I'm glad we got that out in the open, you know.
Yes.
And now, it's important.
Of course, the cost, there's a few points to cost, make the cost high. First of manufacturing, second material, and then third, the approach. Because in a similar, I mean, just like in today's world, there's only two different knot approach: injection molding and machining.
Okay. And machining would be made out of metal and
that usually is in a crossbow. I mean, you don't do regular knot in metal. It doesn't work.
Okay.
And in crossbow, you don't have a choice. And then in the case of material, just even on the same identical material, the approach is such a big deal. Let me explain to you what do you mean by approach is such a big deal. Since we're talking material, I mean, just like if you buy material, polycarbonate is where the material is. Polycarbonate is not polycarbonate. Just like
carbon fiber isn't just carbon fiber.
Right. I mean, it's like I got steel. I got stainless steel. I got case fire hardening. Oh, I got a sword.
Yeah.
From the Egyptian time with the seal that they spent 2 years building it. No, I got the Japanese katana. Then the guy spent 6 months hammering it.
Yeah.
But they're all steel, but that is not the same.
No, they're not built the same. So now that we clarified that, you know, and it's important to understand, like, the whole purpose of this entire science series was to explain, let's be honest, to kind of explain your approach to how things are made, but to also educate people on how arrows behave and how things are made and the flaws in certain processes. And you, everything you make, there is not a single corner cut. You know,
what's the point? I mean, if I cut the corner, why do I even bother? I mean, you know.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's like, yes, enough people will make stuff that is budget friendly.
Right. And at the end of the day, you're paying.
Why do I want to do that?
We as the consumer, we're paying a little extra for that, right? So for the listeners, just understand that. We understand that this stuff is a little bit more expensive than the alternative, but you're not going to get the quality from an alternative that you would here.
Not to the extent.
That's my...
Remember, there's another thing. Actually, it's about what's in your head.
Yeah.
That is actually a bigger factor. But when you know you dot every single dot and cross every single T, from that point onwards, you know it's going to do the best you can be, and you reach that point, and then you fire. Yep. At the end of the day, it's still you. But at least you know whatever you reach to that point is done. And that's the reason, you know, most people have thought archery is a four-month process. My friend, you must be those July 4th guy. But a lot of my customers are actually the full year guy. They the moment the season finished, they start playing and planning for the whole year. Not just that. I mean, the plan, they got the trailer ready. They got everything ready. But that's what they did. But then now let's jump into the knock part.
Yeah. So one of the things you said, we've talked a lot about the knock fit. Why is the knock fit so important? What is it? Why does it matter if a knock is a little loose or a little too tight on the string?
Remember I say the knock is like tires. How loose you know on your rim on your tires, the tires on your rim. Can it be larger than the rim?
No.
I mean, it can be. In some case, you can maybe stretch up to an inch. It will float on beyond it. Not for long. No. What are you losing? Consistency, integrity,
traction,
accuracy, and safety. That's what you're dealing with. But then, now, I noticed that was the biggest in about 2009. when I was doing the measurement. When I find out Martin's string survey is 137,000, I blow my mind. Then I find out it was not just them. That it was 135,000. Then which instantly explained why at that moment Urban Express make a new knock, which will hold that width. In other words, they make the knock a little bit slimmer on this side so the knock can open wider and grab the string. Now, when you do that, I mean, unlike others, I got a FASTech high-speed camera. I did some video for high-speed camera on see the knot. Another way to put a camera right on the knot and see how the knot leave the arrow and how the string actually come back without string stop. That's the reason I know the string stop is a big deal. But then I found the knot is actually even a bigger deal. Like some of the basic knot on how the knot throw design, that means how the two prongs and the knot grabs the string. It's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason I don't know whether you recognize the fire knot, how they grab the string, that whole part is one of my patterns. My first pattern in fire knot.
Yes.
The whole idea is that you grab the string more than 100 and... Actually, I claim 220 degrees. It's 180 degrees plus 20 plus 20.
And then it comes around a little bit.
It comes around. So in other words, the knot actually contains the entire string. This approach actually significantly changed the knot fit requirement. In the old days, the knot is like a... It's like a cup that's rounded. So you push the string all the way down. And now imagine this. If it's just simply nothing more than a round valley, different knot with different material, with different throw, the string is going to hit different spot on that valley. Mm-hmm. Or they're going to spread the knot in different magnitude when they go down. Now, if your material is decent and soft, well, you just open the prong more and the arrow you should okay. But it's not. You're going to break the knock. That's the reason the material and control is so critical. I remember in 2012, one of the company, the technical director called me and said, "Hey, Dodge, all our knocks are breaking." I said, "Did you change the supplier?" "No, it's the same supplier." I say, do you test with them?" He said, "It's the same guy, same machine, everything." I said, "I bet it's the curing process because you told me the material is the same." Sure enough, it was molded in November and somebody opened the door. Mm. That's all it is.
That's all it takes is one door to be open and it changes everything.
Because it changed the curing process of the polycarbonate after injection molding, the crystallization is not long chain. The chain is smaller, which mm-hmm. caused the knot to be brittle. And voila, it cracks. Because you're talking a huge amount of force on the knot throw, which is, remember, a circle end of the point is a point. In the case of a knot, it's a line. If you apply force to that line, if it's not evenly distributed, the force is applied to a line and cause the knot to split. I mean, it's as simple as that.
It seems pretty simple. It seems pretty basic of a concept.
That's the reason in the old days we use yellow, white, green, yellow, and black knots. You know why?
Is it because the color doesn't affect the strength of the material?
No, because the non-translucent knot, the polycarbon chain is multi-directional.
Okay.
That means they're all linked together in all mesh. Sure. So it is harder to crack. The moment you go translucent, you need to look at a translucent carbon. I'm a chemist. You need to look at the carbon structure. It's multi-layers because the molecules are not aligned. Mm-hmm. As the molecules are not aligned, guess what they allow light to pass through? Well, guess what? If they're not aligned and light pass through, what does that also mean? The moment you scratch it or apply extensive force, you crack between those lines.
Gotcha.
That's the reason polycarbonate, translucent polycarbonate, a lot more brittle than solid color. It handles a lot less stress than solid color. It's all chemistry.
Excuse me. No, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. When you put it in that perspective, seems
pretty straightforward. It's like that's the reason in my catalog, I even go so far to draw the oblique structures of a translucent polycarbonate compared to a non-transparent polycarbonate. In some cases, it's a building block. The other one is like solid lines.
Yeah. And the truth is, when you look at the traditional way of building a log cabin, how does it work? One log goes here, another one goes on top, another one goes on top. You're cross-fitting them at that 90 degree for the strength. If they all just met in the corner like this, there wouldn't be any stability.
No, so, it would not. But you want translucent, so you have to let the light through.
But you want translucent. You let the light through. If you're shooting a lighted knock, that's where the translucent is important, right? If it wasn't for a lighted system, It wouldn't matter whether it was see-through or not.
Correct. And that's the reason when you go to a really small knot, like pin knots, you notice that 99% of them are not translucent. Mm-hmm. But then they also cause another problem. If the knot is not translucent, how do you know it's deformed?
You mean on the inside? Like how if the
no,
inside
the entire knot is deformed. It's a small piece.
Where?
When the knot is deformed after you put pressure, now it changes shape without you knowing. Mm-hmm. How do you maintain accuracy when the knot is no longer the same shape?
I guess you don't.
Now you know why, just like when the top shooter, Tim Gillingham, when he shoot the pin knocks, every time he shoot the knock, he put the pin out, he spin the pin to make sure it's right. After four shots, he throw the thing and put a new one on. Because he can't trust it.
Yeah, and I mean, that's also how the guys are making their living. You know what I mean? So it's like, you gotta, like, if you know that after so many shots, the knock isn't as consistent. For those guys, the difference in 2 millimeters could be the difference between winning a competition and losing a competition.
Oh, 2 millimeters.
Even better. 0.2 millimeter. So it's like, you know, so for people like that, that's literally the difference between winning and losing.
Well, actually, as simple as that. If you lose your next guy by 1 point, do you win?
No. Okay. It's like you ever see the Fast and the Furious movies. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if you win by an inch or a mile. Winning is winning.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's the reason. See, this is where knots get really complicated. And then people say, well, you know, it's just a simple piece of plastic. Or simply say, hey, if you're in guns, how about your shell fit to your barrel?
Yeah. Or even
how much off you want it to be?
Or even easier than this, the thing that's overlooked, granted, this isn't a gun podcast, but what about rifles and a cheek and the cheek mount on the stock? That's supposed to sit on your cheekbone. You know what I mean? And people overlook that. You know, like
a lot of people do. I mean, in the crossbow world, you know how many customers keep shaving there until it's perfect fit? And you know why they make all the difference in the world? Except it doesn't matter in hunting.
No.
You know why? You're not on the bench. You're not sitting there.
Right. But what I found, you know, and not we won't get too far down this tangent, but I'm a lefty. Mm-hmm. I'm a lefty. I'm one of those wacky guys. My entire life, I always shot right-handed firearms. Rifle, shotgun, it didn't matter. It was always right-handed until I was old enough to start buying my own stuff. I bought a left-handed shotgun, beautiful Benelli. We've talked about it before. I love it. I've never been so accurate and so consistent with a gun in my life. You know what the biggest difference is between a right-handed shotgun and a left-handed shotgun? There's two.
Are you?
Yeah, there's two differences. The first, which nobody really pays attention to, is the buttstock is angled the opposite of a right-handed shooter, so it sits perfectly in the angle of my shoulder. More importantly, people don't realize that the stock end of a shotgun is canted into the face of a shooter. So when you're right-handed, the stock cants to the left. Well, as a left-handed shooter, that means it's away from my face. So when I bought the Benelli and I was able to adjust it and move things around to custom fit it to myself, all of a sudden, now I could close my eyes and shoulder the gun and I'm dead nuts down the barrel.
Well, that means you didn't do it like I told my daughter to do. You need to put an eye patch on you and use the right hand shoulder, all the things. But you try to use the left hand to shoulder your gun, that's really, it didn't work.
So the thing is, we beat odds in my family where there's 5 of us, my mom, my dad, and I have a brother and a sister. So there's 5 of us total, 3 of us are left-handed. So we defeat the odds. My dad is left-handed, my sister's left-handed. So to my dad, it was never anything to worry about. It was just part of life. You know, you're going to deal with it. But what people don't realize is that everything in this world, literally everything in this world is made for right-handed people. Everything in this world is made for right-handed people.
Not exactly. I mean, you have a left-hand bow, but
sure.
Unfortunately, fortunately, you don't live in Korea. Do you know in Korea there's no left-hand bow, period?
I don't doubt it. But here's the problem. Do they make left-handed bows? Yes. You want to know how many times I've had the opportunity of test shooting left-handed bows? 0. Yeah. In my entire life, not a single shop has ever had a left-handed gun for me to shoot. The safety mechanisms on a chainsaw, they're all right-handed. You drive a stick shift car, it's made for right-handed people. Everything in this world is designed to either be ambidextrous or right-handed. And if you want left-handed,
you go to England or Hong Kong or Japan. Yeah.
And
now you
can. and a lot of times, the things that are made left-handed are actually more expensive because it's considered a custom order.
Correct.
Tell me that's not some bullshit.
Well, that's the reason I said you just need to learn, like My daughter was right hand dominant, but left hand.
That's in my opinion, that's a little bit easier to transition. I have a cousin who was forced, for medical reasons, was forced to learn how to shoot left-handed. He's a natural righty, right eye dominant, right-handed in everything. And he had to teach himself to shoot a bow left-handed, a rifle left-handed. I can't even imagine how tough that must be.
I got a customer like that last year coming to me because football injury. His right hand cannot, his left hand cannot hold a bow. He had to hold a bow with the right hand. And when he put the bow back, his left hand looks really weird.
Yeah.
I said, wait a minute. I was like, yeah, I know. Football injury.
Yeah.
Hey, you live with it. What are you going to do? You can be reborn and even then fix it. But let me go back to the knock since we had about 33 minutes into
it. Yeah, good.
Okay, now, that's the reason the knock translucent and solid color is such a big deal. But then in today's world, most people like the translucent because in some way the translucent is softer. So it protects the string a lot more. Which also explains...
As far as not damaging the serving?
Correct. And not to make it hug the string better.
Interesting. Okay.
But then the softness have a certain limitations. The limitation is about 125 pounds. So if you shoot a bow over 125 pounds on 112,000, the knot is not going to work well.
So you're talking essentially crossbows. If you're shooting a crossbow.
Yeah, the crossbow is different because the knot is significantly bigger. For basic 112,000 with the 4 to 5 millimeter contact surface, 125 pounds is your max. That means if you shoot a G knock of mine, 125 pounds is your max.
Okay.
So but in the case of, if you look at that, the Eastern have published their injection knock, the maximum poundage is 75 pounds.
Okay. Now I'm
at least that's just what I read from their publication.
Right. Now I'm looking to build a set of crossbow bolts for somebody. And originally they wanted pink knocks. So mm-hmm. I went on your website. They want the M knock. They're shooting an Excalibur, but they prefer something that has a notch in it versus the flat back. Whatever. So when I went on the website, you only offer, if I'm not mistaken, green, red, and black. Yeah. Or clear. Is there a specific reason that you don't offer the other colors in a larger diameter?
How many people are buying it?
I don't know. You tell me.
If you do an injection molding process, it's minimum, say, 5,000. Okay. So if I got 2 customers per year buying 7 for it, how many of them are going to sit around?
Most of them.
And then when you do most of the, in the best material, polycarbonate knock shelf life is around maximum 12 years. That means if you buy it, don't use it, let it sit there. After 12 years, it will get brittle.
Thing. I never thought of that.
Yeah, a lot of people never thought.
I've also never had knocks last me more than a year because I shoot too much. But, you know, that's
right. But see, most people don't understand. You're looking at material that has flex. Mm-hmm. But that's translucent. That means it's subject to ultraviolet or any ambient light. That means you're going to degrade. Yeah. So if I go ahead and say make the pink one for, say, one customer, I have 5,000. He bought one pack for 7. I go and have 4,903 sitting, 393 sitting right there.
For a long time.
And then 12, best case scenario, I put them inside a black box. If I sell one pack a year, after 10 years, I have 70 of them sold. Then I'm going to throw 4,930 of them into the garbage.
Yeah.
Am I going to accept that? No.
No, of course not. No, that makes sense. I didn't know, to be honest with you, I thought that different colors had different durability qualities.
No, they do not. Okay. Let me take it back. Yes and no. If you do not use German Mechalon, you do not use the temperature control, you do not use the German Mechalon dye from Bear, answers different color, have different viscosity, has different durometer rating. Mm-hmm. That means the hardness and softness. And then with different weight. But then when you look at some really good stuff like the Bear Mechalons, if you buy the right material, answer is that different color, will have the same as long your curing process is right on. Did I screw up? You bet. I remember 2017, I got a bunch of V-Nax just straight out cracked on me like it was out of style. Guess what? It was mowed in winter by a new guy who didn't know better because it was supposed to mow all night. And the guy was in the shop and then he decided it's too hot. He freaking opened every single window and guess what? All the entire batch of red Nax just cracked on impact. My crack when you put any load on it. Same thing. That's the reason I told that technical director that we are very careful with it. Well, I'm very careful with it, but I cannot guarantee my supplier don't screw up.
Right. But the customer service coming out of your company, in my opinion, is second to none. There are other people that match your customer service, but there is nobody that has better customer service. And what I mean by that is you stand by your products. And if somebody calls you with a problem, there's none of this back and forth bullshit. There's none of this, well, did you do this? Did you do that?
But you do have to ask the questions.
Sure.
I mean, just like, I remember the time when I built the first UNOC. I told the company this is the design, so on. They give me the stuff. I just haven't been checked. Guess what? They use the specification of the drawing of 2005 instead of 2017. No, and 14, sorry. How would I even expect that? Yeah. You wouldn't. They did. But does it cost me dearly? Or you bet. It cost me a lot of headache. I even argue with a customer for a short while. Because I know he's supposed to be right. Well, that's where they're supposed.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give the listeners a perfect example. Because one of the big things that I've always said here on, you know, Wing and Tail is that I don't want to just promote a product simply because somebody's giving me something to do so. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to speak on a product, it's either going to be something that I'm using in the moment or I've used long enough that I could speak on it. So before we were ever partnered together, doing anything together, like I've said before, I've bought your products. And a few years ago, I think it was 2 years ago now, I tried your titanium daggers and I shot them a few times and I must have hit something in the target and the tip of it curled over a little bit. So I called you, we talked about it, and you said the titanium is too strong. It shouldn't happen just from shooting it. You said you probably hit something in the target, but it's within the 30 days. You want new ones? Send them back. I said, okay, no problem. And you took care of it.
That's the easiest policy. That's the reason, you know, I'm, instead of doing argument, I may get a, I mean, if you look at my website, it's written paper. It's a 30-day no fault. You know what 30-day no fault means? That means there's no fault of anybody. If it happens, I either replace or refund it. End of story. No more talking.
You even said in the past, somebody could shoot your arrows, break one in half, say, you know what, I don't like these. And you can say, okay, no problem. Just make sure you send me everything back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no questions asked. I love that.
But
I love
that. Then, of course, if they intentionally do it, I mean, I'll eat the lost ones, but we no longer will be doing business. That's it. I mean, you can't prevent bad personality. You can't prevent bad customers. You're opened up for business. In the case of when my internet is open, how do you know the guy out there? You know, you don't know. Let's go back to the knots.
Yeah.
Now, so we talked about the knot fit already.
Yep.
You notice how important the materials.
I want it real quick because you kind of touched on it, but we didn't really get into it. Standard knots, right? They need to hold the string when they need to hold. They need to release the string when they need to release.
Mm-hmm.
How do traditional knots function in that
sense? Everything and anything. What I mean, just mean like some of the multi-throw knock, the string actually bounced off more than five times or seven times.
What do you mean multi-throat?
When you put a knot on it, click, 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 you can feel the knot going into the string.
So like multiple ridges on each
row? Right.
Okay.
Right. Now remember, 90% of those knots are multi-cavity, multi-mode. Multi-cavity mode.
Mm-hmm.
That means every cavity is a little bit slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
And when they flow it, all the ridges or the knot prong is going to have different density and different geometer.
Yep.
And that bounce the string on it.
Let's say, just to give a visual for the listeners, let's say you have a mold that is 12 inches wide and there are six across the top, six across the bottom. There's going to be one point of injection.
Right in the middle, usually it has to be in the middle.
Right. And then it's going to spread from the middle to the outside, which means the first four are going to have the most fresh, I guess you could say, material. Then the next two are gonna have kind of material, and then the ones on the outside are gonna be semi-cured by the time the material gets there.
No, in most cases, it would not, because you heat the mold, you maintain the temperature, and so on. But what you cannot deal with it is the flow density as you compress it.
Mm-hmm.
As it flows, the pressure in the first closest mold are always higher. From the pressure on the outside, because as you press it, you feel it, you keep on feeling the rest. Two or four, one that got filled, you will keep on applying pressure, which means the material is going to be keep condensing. Unfortunately, when you're dealing with the semi-fluid, the density is proportional to pressure. Mm-hmm. As the pressure increases, those knots will be heavier.
Okay. And then because of this, what we're saying is when you have a multi-ridge knock, and each knock from, first off, we already said each prong on a knock is going to behave slightly differently.
Yes,
and
even on a single cavity, single mold.
Right. And then from knock to knock, each knock is going to behave differently. Mm-hmm. So when you have these multi ridges and each knock is behaving differently and it's bouncing at different rates or doing whatever it wants to do, there's no way to guarantee that every single knock is going to release the string in the exact same way from knock.
All right. And then now look at this. Another design is like, they call it the concave design.
Is that like a really tight V?
The V is actually, see, the knock is supposed to be this. Yep. They are like this.
Okay.
So that they make the lower part deeper. So they can just, as long as the knock is in the valley, the mm-hmm. knock can bounce, but the knock can fall off.
And then the knock is free to move up and down and left.
A little bit, not a lot. Yeah. But now the real question is, when the knock was released on this part, how do you guarantee the right and left, the contact surface, and the release of prong of each side is identical?
You can't, because there's too much play in the valley.
Not just if there's even no too much play. The fact is that the string and the knot would touch. The string serving and the knot contact is not the same every time.
It's not equal. Yeah. No, and that
now, if you look at my original pattern, which is the final pattern, our design said the moment you pass the critical, which is called the shear, the knot is no longer touching the string. Period. That's the reason, every time I told people, if you want to test the final, just buy a pack and then shoot the identical knot that you use, especially mm-hmm. on the S-class, A-class, and G-class. Put it through the chronograph. You'll find out the final knot will give you half a speed all the way to 2 feet per second faster because there's no more contact from the string to the knot and the release is cleaner.
I love that. And we're going to talk about why here in a second. I just want to make sure that we cover all of the non-fire knock style stuff first quickly mm-hmm. because I want the listeners to see the value in what the fire knock knocks offer. Now, we have the multi-ridge knocks. We have yes. the cut-wave knocks.
And then we have the strict knocks, which is also some of them out there.
Just perfectly straight. And are those
right, which also mean that the string is going to bounce between the two sides, isn't it?
Right. So basically, if I'm speculating here, tell me if I'm right or not. But it sounds like traditional aero knocks, you either need to choose, is the knock going to be secure on the string at rest, or is the knock going to release from the string cleanly? It doesn't. It sounds like the big issue is you can't have both.
Well, actually, that's not true.
Okay.
That was one knock called the, not a tuna knock, it's an EQ-knock. The EQ-knock is the only knock I know that would do that. Unfortunately, the company's gone. What it is that a knock actually grabs the string and it will clap itself. It's a multi-piece knock. So mm-hmm. you let the knock actually come in and then engage it and close it and hold the string really nice. When you mm-hmm. shoot it, come by, you open up yourself and then that goes. Is that design good? Mechanically, it's perfect. Unfortunately, it is a mechanical piece. That means there's moving parts.
And anything
how do you guarantee the moving parts exactly behave the same? Answer, you can't. You can't.
You can't.
Especially when you got cold weather, moisture, and so on, the mechanical piece. I mean, most people, when you shoot 25 yards, that's no problem. But then ask yourself this question. How much more complication you want to put in there?
You know, it seems like everything we've talked about is, you know, if you don't shoot over 25 yards, maybe you don't need to worry about it too much.
Yes, but a lot of things don't really have too much problem. I mean, it's like, how do I say it? Do you really need rifles in your barrel? Well, if you don't shoot over 25 yards, I don't really think you need to worry too much.
Right. But now here's my question, though. If using a standard knock at 25 or under is minimal, okay, fine. And then having arrow shafts that are made concentrically and even walled, you know, the difference at 25 yards is minimal. Then the broadheads, minimal. The inserts, minimal. The vanes, minimal. Well, if you compound all of those minimal factors, all of a sudden it's not minimal anymore. It's not minimal. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, if let's say you're building an arrow and you say, you know what, I can't justify spending this amount on this component. Fine. If you're going to skip the corner on one component, you're probably going to be okay. But if you cut a corner on all the components, it's just a world of trouble. So like any one of these things that are kind of left alone, granted over the 275, right? That magic number, you know. Now, before we get into fire knock, because I think we've kind of exhausted all of the manufacturing, like the different types of knocks.
Mm-hmm.
What's really, really important, and we've kind of, I think we touched on this a little bit in the past, but I want to make sure we talk about it again today,
mm-hmm.
is that most, I don't want to say all companies, because I don't know for sure that it's all companies, but most knock companies will make knocks, They have multiple cavities in their mold, which means every time they inject material, they're making 4, 6, 12, 18, whatever, however many NOx. Yeah. And then there's a lot of waste or scrap, right? They pull the NOx out. All of the transitions from cavity to cavity, you have to cut those off. They they regrind those. And they put them back into the batch for the next set of NOx. What types of issues does recycling material cause?
Actually, it's not a recycling, it's called regrind.
Right. But for the ease of the listener, I think recycling, it's easier to understand, you know?
You introduce a huge amount of dust second the condition of bubble because the material is no longer virgin. Non-virgin material, that means the control of the durometer, in other words, the flexibility of the material. Because it went through one pressure already. I mean, if you are in chemistry, this is the carbon and carbon chain, flexibility between two carbon molecules are no longer consistent because it's no longer a pure material. You went through a curing process at least once. You went through a pressurized process at least once.
And when,
what's the difference?
When you cure, I think I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. When a product, when a material gets injected in liquid form, and it cures and it comes out as a solid form. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the chemistry in that product has changed, right?
Not really.
Okay.
It is the curing process. That's the reason when you design something in what you call a translucent polycarbonate, number one thing is that you want to make sure all surfaces is identical, as similar length, width, thickness as possible. Because see, unlike other material, polycarbonate translucent is cured from the outside in. That means the inside part of the plastics are always softer than the outside. So it behaves like an exoskeleton entity. So the most important part of a NOx on a translucent, especially translucent, the hardest is on the outside shell. That means if you disturb that shell, that means you make scratches and so on. Mm-hmm. Guess what? It's like, can you put a crack on a cricket and expect to survive? Mm-mm. Same thing.
Okay.
It's like putting a crack on a crab. Well, the crab's dead.
All right. No, that makes sense.
And at the same time, the worst part is that if you introduce those, that's the reason on all translucent polycarbonate, the scratching of the NOx is so, so, so critical. That's the reason, you know, I put enough words. If you miss the target, or if your arrow goes through an enamel, change your NOx because you can't trust it no more.
And the second you hear your NOx hit each other, change the NOx also.
Right. Anytime. In other words, if they're not make contact to anything else besides the string,
change the knock. Okay, that's a very straightforward recommendation.
Yeah, because you can't trust it. I mean, when you can't trust it, why do you want to use it if you can't trust it? The worst part is it.
Yeah, that's like dating, right? If you can't trust them, why stay with them?
Exactly.
You know, actually, that's the way I look at it.
But just like if you got a gun and you know your safety is not safe, would you want to put it in your holster?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's that's a great point you make. I mean, shit, if my dad knows I shared this story, he's gonna fucking kill me. But
no, don't worry about it. I don't want him to kill you.
I'll tell it anyway.
Well, we're gonna finish the day, but then I think it's gonna last me for the talking about because not get a lot more complicated in crossbow world. So today I want to stop at vertical bow world, and we'll talk about crossbow now because it is such a big deal.
Okay,
we talk about material, we talk about design, we talk about cavities, we talk about I want to finish today with the shaft fit.
Okay, so talk about shaft fit, and then I actually want to go one step farther and talk about your fire knock knocks as themselves because they work. Sure. They work incredibly. So knock fit. Why is when you say knock fit? We've already talked about the fit to the string and why the fit to the string is so important. Why is the fit to the arrow shaft itself so important? Like, why does it matter if a knock is a little loose or a little too tight? Like, whatever, big deal.
Are you kidding me?
Whatever.
Well, let's go back to the original number. What is a 166?
A 166 is a class of arrows between...
You say it right. It's a class of arrow about 160,000. That's what it's about.
Yeah, let's see if I remember. Is it, I want to say, it's 162 to 168.
It's 164.5 to 166.5.
I wasn't even close. Okay.
But see, people say, that's me about 1,500. So 166 on a 1,500 is 1%.
And it's not just that. We're talking about a piece of equipment that goes from zero energy to max energy like that. You know what I mean? Like we're talking about something that is going from not moving at all 200 plus miles per hour in literally a fraction of a second. Every single
full energy transfer using that pointer.
Exactly. Every single percent matters, in my opinion.
Yeah, but then in the 204, 204 is another one of them. 204 is a tuple class. The smaller is 2015. That's made by carbon impact. And the largest is 207. That's made by element.
And there's a lot less material. And then when you're looking at a 166, I mean, I have a set of knocks back here if you want me to go grab them. But when we're talking about the material between a 166 knock, a 204 knock, and a 246 knock, the difference is astronomical.
No, actually, I wouldn't talk. See, the 166 knock for us is 2.8 grain. And the 246 is 5. And the 204 is 5. And the 246 is 9. And the 300 on the vertical bow, that means gold 22 on the V-knot, is about 11. So you think of a 246 is 9 compared to 2.8, well, that's 300% in material.
That's what I'm saying. So, like, what I'm getting at is if you shoot a 246 or a 300, you could get away with a knock. It's the same, how do I put it? It's the same thing like we were talking about with the inserts when we were talking about the different arrow classes.
You can put glue in it, but not, you can, there's no glue.
Right. And when you're talking about the percentage on a 166, each millimeter is a much larger percentage of a 166 compared to a 246, 300.
Now, just so you understand, it's not a millimeter. A millimeter would be a very big number. The fact is that the 166 variance is 1.5 thousandths of an inch.
Right. Which means they matter even more. That's
I mean, yes. Even they're small, it matters. And then, of course, the 246. The 246 is a really misunderstood size because everybody called it standard. But do you call ACC 360 a standard? It's 240,000. Then the case of the carbon impact is 242. The case of a carbon force is 243. The case of an Eastern and Carbon Express is 244. And the case of a Black Eagle is a 245.
I see a pattern.
And then the case of a Gold Deep is 246. And Element is 247.
And let's put it this way. Everyone's going to have their preference, right? People who have had success with a 166, they're probably just going to shoot a 166 for all of eternity.
Let me give you example of how interesting the subject matter is. When Eastern come up with the 166, they figured they use their G-knot. Mm-hmm. But guess what? The Eastern 166 is not 166, it's 1665. Mm-hmm. The G-knot fall right off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's exactly.
Right. And we're talking about 5/10,000ths.
Yes.
5/10,000ths.
No. It's actually 0.0005. It's half thousandths.
Right. That's what I'm saying. So it's like, it's wicked. But the point I'm trying to get at is with all of the knowledge that I have, right, we've covered a lot over the last couple of years talking, whatever. All of the information I have and the ability for me to build whatever arrow I want with whatever components at my fingertips, I still chose to build a 246.
Yes.
When it came to hunting, that was of everything I know, I settled on a 246.
Yeah, for you. I mean, for most of my other customer, like the older customer, the same age in 60 or 70, 80 years, they all choose the 300 because they just absolutely, first of all, you don't really want to grab something that small. Second, the holding is so much better. Second, the energy transfer is better. But then you just heard me say it right. The 246 is 242 to 247. In other words, when you fit the knot to it, that's where the magic began. I mean, just like, of course, if Black Eagle would definitely make a knock that would fit the arrow shaft the best. But when you buy Fire Knock, what arrow are you buying it for? Your arrow. That's where all the problem is, and I have fixed it. That's the reason there's another pattern in Fire Knock, which is the original Fire Knock pattern, is that I have found a way called an off-center pressure. So imagine this cylinder, and I put 4 points on the side. So, and you change the cylinder shape like this,
yes,
and then points up here. And I want they are not 60 degrees apart. They're 100 degrees apart.
100, I think you said, right? They're 100
degrees? Yes, 100 degrees apart. So you're forcing the knock to behave like oval. When you force an oval knock, now you're in cover 5 to 6 thousandths of the variance.
And it still remains concentric to the arrow? Right,
because the knock is a single cavity and the bridges are concentrically distributed. But then you're also forcing it to apply force evenly over an oval shape. I mean, I know I'm going into... I mean, if you're into geometry, you gotta, I mean, it's like, how can you not love this stuff?
I mean, I love geometry. You know, now I think the best part, like the way FireNock knocks are built, is incredible. And we're gonna we're gonna get into the lighted knock portion in the next episode, I think, when we cover crossbow. But with how awesome the building is and how much attention there is to detail and the chemistry and the science and everything, like, that's all great. But even better than that is, I think the way that they function is absolutely incredible.
And actually, the best way for most people who really want to go into dive in subject, read the first final pattern description. I mean, like a PhD dissertation in some way, but it's not really a good pattern document, but it was a fun document because I didn't know better.
And never mind the patent document. If you guys really want like a cool visual understanding of what's going on, Dorge posts his, I guess, the dealer videos, like the lessons, I guess, or the presentations where all the information is shared more in depth than even we're covering here, to be honest with you. Those videos are available to the general public. Anybody
can go on FireNock TV. Under FireNock TV.
Yeah, anyone can go on FireNock TV.
I got something to announce today. The 2025 catalog is printed. So all one who bought it got a 2025. And I also got them on the FireNock under support. You can download the PDF.
You're going to have to send me a couple of them when you send me my next batch of arrows.
Absolutely. No problem.
But where was I going with that? On FireNock TV, when you watch these instructional videos, underneath them in the description is a link to the presentation that he uses in his...
It's a presentation dialogue. And I would, that's a presentation notes. That's also in Google Doc.
That presentation was so big for me. That presentation document, for me to be able to go and pause the video and look at the images. You know, if there's anything here that we're talking about that you want a little bit of clarity on, those presentations, there's nothing to be hidden. There's no smoke and mirrors here. Like literally everything you need is out there for you to see, but the visuals there are absolutely incredible. Now, what I was getting at was, now correct me if I'm wrong, because I have this idea in my head of how FireNock knocks work. In one of your diagrams, it shows a little ball at the very base of the throat of the knock.
Yes.
The way I understand it is when you attach a knock to the string, the knock grabs it, right? So it grabs onto the string. Mm-hmm. And then when you release that string, the way it looks to me is that ball gets pressed in, which then forces the knock open, which then releases it from the string.
No, actually, it's not correct. It forces in, and the moment, actually, you think of it's a multiple moments. When you first shoot it, because it's contained, the force is all point towards it because it's the same identical curve. So the force is not on a point, on a line, but on an entire surface. Mm-hmm. That's the reason 112,000 is so critical, because you want to distribute the load over the entire surface.
Okay.
Now, as of course, when the finally you hit the point, the knot is going to relax. The string is going to move forward. Remember, you're still within the same circle. The string is 112,000 and the knot is 113,000. Actually, more like 112.5. So now the string is still going to move a little bit. Now you go to the forward. Now the string is pushing towards the shear. The entire knot prong is going to open. And the moment the string passes the prong, how many surfaces is the string touching? Two lines.
Yeah.
Now it's behaving like a shear of a gun. Now the string is off without making any more contact to the knot. That was the pattern.
And that's where your pattern is. It holds the long story short, to simplify it, it holds the string when it's at rest, and it releases the string when you release the arrow.
With no more contact to the prong.
I love that.
Like, and not to mention, of course, the reason for me, people say, okay, you already talk about the left and right prong is not the same because the left and right prong do not behave the same. But you notice every single FireNock knock, the left and right prongs are identified. So when you put your knock on your string, you want to make sure your knock are all facing the same direction on every one of the arrow, and so that the left and right are always firing the same. Remember, the knocks, arrow, and bow are never, ever truly perfect center all the way. But you want to replicate the identical launch every time.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to show this on camera.
That's okay. I mean, they can look at look at their own knot when they got it. I mean, it's not just me. Everybody does it.
I have a knock here, and I'm going to keep turning it right there. If you guys can see it, right there on the edge. The there's an index there, and that serves two purposes. Number one, if I'm not mistaken, that's the side of the injection, right? That's the side where you inject the material.
All right, into, and that direction, you can feel it.
Right, and you can feel it, which means A, make sure that it's either always to the right or to the left when you knock your arrow. And also it means that if you set this up so that way that index faces the same direction every single time you shoot, you can, again, not guarantee exact, but you can guarantee that your knocks will behave as close to identical to each other as possible.
Well, you do know why I make that thing so big?
No, but I think you're going to tell me.
You imagine this. They're now in the middle. You just shot a first deer. Mm-hmm. And then the deer is, for whatever reason, I mean, say there was a leaf you did not see. Now the deer is alert. You're staring at the deer. You want to launch another arrow. Do you know which way your cock ring is? You grab your hand towards the arrow while you are staring at the deer. You want to be able to grab the arrow and know which way it is. Yep. You want to do the whole thing by feel. That's the reason it's critical.
Yep. Now what I do, and I don't know about other people. I just had an arrow here. But what I've always done is, well, not always. I used to fletch my arrows with the cock vein out. I've since started to fletch my arrows with the cock vein up. I feel like it gives me just a little bit more clearance on my face. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know. But what that means is I can only knock my arrow two ways, vein up or vein down. And if I knock it vein up or vein down, I know it's wrong. So I actually have two indexes built into my arrows when I put them on.
Cool. All right, then let's go. We'll live for next week. We'll talk about the crossbow knocks and also the final component.
Okay.
On the final knock.
Right, and I wanted to the plan or the original plan was to get into arrow concept next week, but it sounds like we're going to push that one more week beyond, right? So next week
we'll talk about... we have not really... I want to finish this because this is such a technical subject. Mm-hmm. And I think I need to spend a bit of time explaining the system architecture.
Absolutely.
If some customers were wondering why it is so different. And because, we're talking software, hardware, math, sine wave. Yeah.
And crossbow... And crossbow's its own, in my opinion, like, I don't know. So... I'm not ashamed to say it. My dad bought us, my brother and I, he bought us crossbows about 10 years ago. The buck that's on my wall behind me, that was shot with a crossbow when I was in college. I didn't have the time to go to the shooting range as much as I would have liked. So I felt like a crossbow was more efficient for me to use at the time.
No. Most people understand, when you hunt, it's not the equipment that matters. It's, you know, the quarry. Just like you can have the least or best amount of equipment, you need to find yourself in front of the deer. Because if people think because of equipment make you somebody, you're out of your mind. No, it's the way that you're able to put yourself within the range of that animal that you want to kill. Now, that's the real deal.
Now, in the last 10 years, crossbows have just increased exponentially. Like the ability
of crossbows. Crossbows are always big. We just don't know it. Just like, you know, I'm giving an idea. When I met Francis out of PSE, or Jeffrey John and A, when he was still at PSE, he told me there's over 60 to 70% of the deer killed in Ohio is with crossbows. That's when crossbows. Remember, I mean, that's a huge amount of people just don't have the time to practice. Mm-hmm. And not to mention, you can buy a crossbow at finger height with $375, pay over 12 months. You've got a crossbow system that can kill.
And that you can go out and hunt with immediately.
Right. And imagine this. You want to spend some money on a vertical boost setup, say a manual setup. What do you think your setup cost is going to be before any camo?
I mean, the bow alone is over $1,000 easy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not including any of the accessories, the sight, the rest, the stabilizers, whatever else.
Well, one of my customers just called me. He said, George, I need to send you my bow, my new Hoyt RX9 with everything on it. You titanium kit it for me. You send it back. I say, how much you want to insure it? I pay over $3,400 for it.
And that's what I'm saying, you know? And this is a good segue, and we'll end on this. I'm gonna plug Dart in here for a second. We've talked about it in the past a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've shot multiple brands in the past. I've shot, mm-hmm. I grew up shooting Matthews, which I have my own reservations about at this point, but that's, I have no, how do I put this? Matthews has never done me wrong. Right. Mm-hmm. Like I haven't had a bad experience with the Matthews, my own personal opinion. So I don't want to poison the waters at all there.
Mm-hmm.
From a Matthews, I went to a Hoyt. From a Hoyt, mm-hmm. I went to an Expedition. From an Expedition, mm-hmm. I went back to a Hoyt, and now I'm in a Darton. Mm-hmm. What I love about Darton, for whatever reason, They're significantly cheaper than the competitors. They are. They're at least $300 cheaper than a Hoyt, a Matthews, an Expedition, an Elite of the same caliber. But then they also have lower end, and air quotes for those of you who aren't watching, lower end bows that are more entry level that are in the $600 range. Mm-hmm. And I will honestly say, after shooting all of these different flagship bows and brands and big names, I don't feel like I've left anything on the table with the Darton. It's got great speed. It has great control. Granted, it doesn't have any of these big tuning things, but we've talked about the problems with the different tuning and the set screws and all this stuff. You know, so if there's anybody listening to this, and we really try, we try on this podcast to try to promote things for the working man, people who maybe mm-hmm. don't have endless pockets. If you're someone out there who wants a reliable bow and something that you can feel comfortable taking to the field, to a target range, to 3D, whatever the case is, give Darton a shot. I understand that they're not the biggest name out there.
Darton as a company, if you know history of the Darton, I will tell you, when Rex Darlington will have the company, he technically have owned all the patents. Mm-hmm. The Darton is now owned by Randy and his friends. Randy Kicks, the guy who owned Black Eagle. It's a really decent bow. And the most important part, I feel Darton good, is that it was actually the pro staff is where the, what's his name? Jason Wilkins. I mean, that guy know his shit. Sorry.
Yeah, it's all good.
He know his stuff and his bows are really good because I would say he's one of the best shooter out there. If you have to think about it, I think I even put him over Levi Morgan as long as somebody tell him the range.
Okay.
You're just not good at ranging.
Right.
That's you know, the guy went over $1 million on crossbow shoots.
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying, you know, like the thing is, for people who don't know this history, right? For the people who don't know this history, they think Darton just came out of nowhere. But no, Darton has been around for decades upon decades upon decades. But what's, like you already said, the beautiful thing about Darton, if you've shot any major brand bow, probably with the exception of Matthews, in the last 20 years, you have shot Darton technology.
Yes, the only thing that Matthew have not used any of the Darton technology so far. Then if you know Hoyt, the original cam and half, that's Darton's. The 2.5 cam, that's Darton's.
Exactly.
The binary cam from the Elite, that's Darton's.
And here's the beautiful part. The beautiful thing and what I really love about shooting a Darton now is like something like the E system, the tuning system that Darton had a couple years ago. They have it on their target bows a lot. What I love about it is they say, okay, we've invented all of this different technology and we're going to license it to you and we're going to license it to you and we're going to license it to you, but we're going to keep the best for ourselves. And that E system, they haven't licensed it to anyone as far as I'm concerned.
I'm not familiar with E system, so I don't know anything about it. But anyway, I think, yeah, there's a lot of really smaller, good bow companies. Some of them are ridiculously expensive. I happen to know most of them. I mean, I'm able to make a phone call and some people answer. Some people don't. I mean, Should not blame them because they may be too busy or I'm just not worth talking to. I understand.
I have no reservations against Hoyt. I didn't leave Hoyt because they were a bad brand. I just had an opportunity with Darton. I have a friend of mine who just picked up a VTM brand new. It was just old new stock. He absolutely loves it. And when he talked to me about it, I was shooting the original Ventum. I said, if you could get it for a good price, absolutely 100% get it. It's a phenomenal bow, with the exception of horizontal knock travel.
I will close today with this comment. No matter which bow you buy, you make sure you deal with a dealer who really shoot one or two brands. Don't go to a dealer and say, we have every brand. Whatever you want, we'll settle for you. Right. Those are the worst.
Why is that? Because they're not professionals in one brand.
They don't know the ins and outs enough of one specific bow. Because it's like everything else. You need to spend time with the brand and spend time with the product enough to find out its problem, because not everybody will have the same problem, but everybody eventually will have the problem, and you see enough of it, you're finally able to know, with this boat, with the customer like this, this is what they're seeing and that's how I'm going to help him.
Exactly.
That's what you're getting.
And I will leave you with this. It's the same thing in education. When you get to middle school, high school, college, you have one teacher that is specialized in a specific subject. Mm-hmm. But kids come out of elementary school being weak, Let's be honest. Kids are weak in math coming out of elementary school. Why? You expect an elementary school teacher to be proficient in English, reading, writing, math, science. You expect them to be proficient in all of these subjects. And it's just not, it doesn't work. The model does not work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my opinion. We've mm-hmm. talked about this off the air a lot, you know? So it's, again, same thing like you said, you know, definitely better if you have a shop either that specializes in one or two brands or have been around for so damn long that they do know the ins and outs of all of the different brands.
That yeah, would but be that's very few because you. Yep. Even with long ones, a long-term brand, because the only good is the Botec. Mm-hmm. Very few manager really know that well. And that's where the problem lies. All right.
Yeah.
I'll just close it today. And like that, I will answer a few phone calls that call me. All right.
Absolutely. Guys, as always, thank you so much for joining in for another episode of the Wing and Tail Boys here. We love having Dorge. Hopefully we're simplifying the information for you as well as we possibly can. That's my goal. If not, just leave a little comment down below. Let us know if there's something that maybe we didn't cover as well as you would have liked or you're still confused on. And, you know, we'll make sure we touch on it in the upcoming episodes. With that said, if you think the information here was pretty cool, share it with a friend of yours. I'm sure they think it's pretty cool too. It definitely helps the channel out and you'll be helping a friend out also. And if you don't mind, scroll on down to the bottom there, leave a nice little review. 5-star review goes a long way, and a little written review, a couple words, lets us know what you like, what you don't like, and we can do a lot of things with that. So as always, thanks again for joining us this week, and until next time, remember, success is just a commitment away. Have a great week, ladies and gentlemen.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.